Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you the spiritual world with Maria D'Andrea. Greetings and welcome, Maria. How are you this evening?
Wonderful. Thank you so much for the introduction. You're always so wonderful. So I wanted to say that I always say Isten Hozat, or welcome in Hungarian. And if somebody's listening to the show, they're going to be very, very thrilled because we have Peter Moon tonight as a guest. And he is a well-known author of several books and the publisher of Sky Books. And we'll be speaking mainly about his recent book, The Rise World Deception and the Demystification of World War II. He is phenomenal. And I just wanted to say welcome to the show, Peter.
Oh, thank you. It's nice to be with you again, Maria.
Well, we've known each other for years, and I love that you give people information that most do not have access to. And honestly, even if they knew what it was about, they probably couldn't find it because you're so wonderful at finding things that the public needs to know but doesn't know. So tell me a little bit about your recent book. I read it, and it's fantastic.
Well, The Roswell Deception is a book that I collaborated on with Douglas Dietrich. And Douglas Dietrich is the first person in the history of the world to come forth and admit to having burned government documents.
And that's amazing that he came forward.
Yes. And many of these documents he burned concerned World War II. His job was a Defense Department research librarian and a documents destruction specialist. Most people aren't probably aware that there's such a thing as a documents destruction specialist.
I would think so without knowing the name, though, right?
Well, exactly. And his information and what he has been able to access through his very unusual life, he is watched very closely by politicians, particularly as saying he's the world's foremost expert on the Far East, because he breaches into the occult area, which is an area that I'm familiar with and deal with, so that's why I'm able to deal with him. But to make a long story short, the whole Roswell phenomena, aliens, and all this stuff is a whole government operation. Book is not a forum on aliens.
Right, because you're right, Peter, I know you wrote about the mystique connected to Roswell in a very interesting way so that people can easily understand it, because sometimes I find authors, and, you know, I don't mean it negatively because you and I are both authors, but they get so convoluted. And they write in a way where you have to be already an expert. And I find you always write in a way that's understandable to everybody so that you can get the information across in a phenomenal way.
Well, thank you. And that's exactly what I try to do. And I open this book by giving an introduction to who Douglas Dietrich is, more elaborate than what I just said. But I also begin it with an opening statement, much as an attorney would give. It's written in the vernacular of an attorney. And basically what it says is it presents the deconstruction of two major myths that have been perpetrated upon the world, particularly America, that have had an extremely negative impact with regard to understanding history and how things really were in World War II and current events as they actually are. And this begins with the Office of War Information. Is something that most people don't even know what it is or was the Office of War Information. I don't know. It told us about the war. Well, there is a man who headed it named Elmer Davis. And Elmer Davis is seen in this movie. What is that movie with Michael Rennie? The Flying Saucer Lands in Washington, D.C. It's a classic.
Oh,
the Day the Earth Stood Still. The Day the Earth Stood Still. Elmer Davis is featured in that movie as reporting on the aliens. Now, that movie was a, as is all of Hollywood, was co-op to make us think, oh, there's aliens, we're aliens. I mean, if you look at all those movies, they were right. trying to convince the public that there were aliens. Why? Why would they? And they've been holding on to this forevermore. Now, beginning with Elmer Davis and the Office of War Information, an extensive false mythology has been created surrounding the actual circumstances and military facts of World War II. Through control of media outlets, including Hollywood, a myth has been created and successfully indoctrinated into the minds and routine thinking patterns of the population, convincing the public of two major myths. Myth number one is the Empire of Japan was an aggressor nation who attacked Pearl Harbor without provocation nor just cause, and further, as a direct result of atomic bombs being dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, Imperial Japan surrendered unconditionally, it being announced by Emperor Hirohito on August 15th and formally signed on September 2nd, 1945, aboard the USS Missouri, thus bringing the hostilities of World War II to a close. This is completely false.
Which is basically, that's the only thing everybody's ever, ever heard. So when you delve into all this unknown information, that, by the way, I know has been documented and looked into. And by the way, I just want people to know that you deal in the field of the occult, but you also deal very heavily into the field of science. And they are connected fields. So it's not that you just research something without actually knowing what's going on with it.
Well, of course, and this is all, I mean, this can be deconstructed in actual history. But so, for example, and I'll just give one sample because we go into it extensively in the book, but it says everybody thinks that the World War II was over in 1945 aboard the USS Missouri. Well, President Truman, you can see it on YouTube, he declares an end to hostilities of World War II on the last day of 1946. 1946, he's declaring an end to hostilities. Now, furthermore, if you look up the treaty signed between the United States and the Empire of Japan, it is signed in September of 1951 and goes into effect on the Emperor's birthday in April of 1952.
Huh.
Now, this is like, you know,
right.
And it's like, exactly. Now, and I personally, in Los Angeles Harbor, and I mention it, and I even show pictures in the book, I saw a ship in 1958 or 59. I'm with my father in L.A. Harbor. We're going fishing. And he always showed me the ships in Japan. And then one day we saw a ship with the Japanese war flag. I said, what is that, Dad? Why do they have the war flag?
Okay, now, by the way, I didn't want to interrupt you, but some people, and you did say in an explanation the difference between their flag and their war flag. So could you mention the difference?
Well, the Japanese flag has a red dot. The Japanese flag has a red sun in the middle with a white flag. It's red, but the war flag has red rays going out.
Well, see, now most people don't know that.
Well,
and that's very interesting because it makes a big difference in the story.
Well, of course, I knew it because my father was at Pearl Harbor. He was at World War II. Of course, he taught me this, but I saw the war flag, and I said, why is that war flag there? And he said, I don't know. I'll look into it. He never could figure it out. But then I found that the Japanese had war flags in L.A. Harbor in 1959. I got the picture in there, which had to do with a treaty that was, or an argument between Japan and America. So anyway, this myth is completely deconstructed because Japan was attacked by the United States by Commodore Perry in the early 50s, who were trying to, and they cut off the trade to Japan in pre-World War II. So, but anyway, and Japan paid no war reparations whatsoever to the United States. They didn't pay any. They paid war reparations to Thailand and some other countries in Asia, but not to the United States.
Now, that doesn't seem the norm.
No, it's not normal. Yeah, but it's all of history has been convoluted, and
right.
We go deep into what happened. But because we only have a limited amount of time, I'm going to go into myth number two. Myth number two, which is going to be more interesting to people perhaps, based upon, myth number two, based upon a July 8, 1947 press release from Roswell Army Air Field, Public Information Officer Walter Haught, the seeds of a myth were created when a story was circulated in the Roswell Daily Record that personnel from the field's 509th Operations Group had recovered a flying disc which had crashed on a ranch near Roswell. This included a report that an intelligence officer of the 509th Bomb Group stationed at Roswell Army Air Force, Major Jesse Marcel, had recovered a flying disc from the range lands of an unidentified rancher in the vicinity of Roswell, and that the disc had been flown to higher headquarters. That same story also reported that a Roswell couple claimed to have seen a large unidentified object fly by their home on July 2, 1947. As
right.
a continuance of this myth and adding complexity to it, the July 9th edition of the Roswell Daily Record featured two headlines, Ramey empties Roswell saucer and harassed rancher who located saucer, sorry he told about it. Then it goes into this whole story of Roswell. They take it back. They say it's a weather balloon. And they're right. creating this like, oh, well, here it is. It's a flying saucer. Oh, no, it's not a flying saucer. It's a weather balloon, which makes people think it is a flying saucer.
Exactly.
That's deliberate. That's
mm-hmm.
deliberate.
Yeah, they're mind games.
Exactly. Very clever. Eventually, the myth of aliens crashing at Roswell became institutionalized with the International UFO Museum and Research Center being erected at Roswell, all followed by a new public clamor as a book entitled The Day After Roswell is published, written by Philip Corso and Bill Burns. Corso, who was a special assistant to the head of Army Research and Development, Lieutenant General Arthur Trudeau, and was in charge mm-hmm. of the Foreign Technology Desk, claims that modern technology had been in part the result of reverse engineering technology that was discovered in the Roswell craft. And this is all a deconstruction of this, and it's a big lie, what was written in that book by Corso.
Right.
And Corso was publicly lambasted by Strom Thurmond because he put a false endorsement by Strom Thurmond of the book. And Strom Thurmond says, I didn't endorse it. He lied.
Right.
He lied.
And wasn't Goddard actually a rocket scientist?
Who? Who?
The gentleman just said Dr. Robert
no.
Goddard? I
no,
thought he
Goddard,
was
but this isn't about Goddard. This is about,
I'm not talking
about Robert Goddard. Robert Goddard, he's involved in the story, but he's not part of what I just said.
Right.
I said Philip Corso. Who was
right.
Who lied in his book, and they were forced to take all those books back, and they
right.
turned them over in less than a week's time. That's how much the government was behind this book.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah, the mm-hmm. day after Roswell, which completely captured the imaginations of people, getting everybody to think that this is all alien technology, when so much of the technology that the United States has quote-unquote reverse-engineered or copied is Japanese technology. Japanese are a civilization that's thousands of years old, and they're far
right.
more advanced technologically than the United States. But, and of course, there's deeper aspects to go on. I don't know if you have any questions or you want to steer me in a direction right now.
No, that's why I just wanted to ask you because I was going to say, you know, with the gentleman that was the pioneer in rocket scientist, you know, I remember you were saying something about the balloons.
Well, Robert Goddard.
Saying,
I'm sorry.
That were overwhelming because didn't they hire him to make some kind of a rocket because the balloons coming out of Japan. If I'm not mistaken.
I will explain that.
That would be great because that would be interesting.
The Japanese were very advanced in balloon technology. These weren't
mm-hmm.
weather balloons. These were, you know, balloons. But the balloons at Roswell were not what I'm talking about. The Japanese had what were called Fugo balloon bombs. And they were sending balloons. I'm sorry?
I said that's what I was wondering about, because you were saying there's so much conspiracy here, and I thought that that was part of.
Well, let me explain.
Mm-hmm.
The Japanese were sending thousands of balloons over that were balloon bombs, and they were designed to crash and make fires, make huge fires. The purpose of the fires was not to destroy the United States. The purpose of the fires was to map the wind currents of the United States, because they had even bigger balloons, which were huge balloons, and they would better be called dirigibles, super dirigibles, that were as big as 300 football fields long, and they were lifted with hydrogen, not helium. Hydrogen's very flammable. But this way, they could steer these balloons over the United States if they wanted to and knew the wind currents. Now, Emperor Hirohito was a marine biologist, and he studied the wind currents of the Pacific. He studied these for purposes of war. His whole history has been obfuscated and is not understood. But they came to Robert Goddard because they had all of these balloons coming over, and the United States says, oh, they went to him as a rocket expert. Maybe you could develop rockets to shoot them down. And he looked at them and he said, well, you know, these balloons cost, you know, are very cheap. They just maybe cost, you know, $15 or $20 to send up these balloons, no more than 50. But it costs hundreds, if not thousands of dollars to develop rockets. And you've got all these balloons coming along and you can't even reliably shoot them down. So they basically, you know, that was how Robert Goddard fit into it. So the United States organized troopers to fight the fires.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a whole scandalous story in itself, because they took black African Americans who were conscientious objectors, because the blacks were not into the war, and they would go into to do this. Now, they also had white people who were conscientious objectors who fought the fires, but the triple nickels were the black ones, and they pulled a very dirty trick on the black ones. They created parachutes that would not open.
Oh.
And so these guys would go down and jump out of the parachutes and die. They would be killed. And this was genocide. This was genocide. And they hid it because if you look up triple nickels, they were unit 555 parachute infantry, smoke jumpers. And they hid the history by spelling nickels wrong. Should be spelled N-I-C-K-E-L-S, but they spelled it L-E-S, so it would be hidden in the files. It was called triple nickels because it was 555, the 550 parachute infantry. So this is a complete scandal of, you know, just this is genocide against black people. And so it's not that the Germans were the only ones engaged in wholesale killing of people.
Right.
And you don't hear any of this. But answers how Robert Goddard came in the situation. But what had happened is when Emperor Hirohito was a young man, he knew English, and he had read a story by Jack London, a famous reporter, and there's Jack London Square in Oakland, California. He's that famous. And Jack London had written a story called The Unparalleled Invasion, where he advocated the extermination of the yellow race. Because he had served in reporting the war, the Russian-Japanese war, and he hated the Japanese, he hated the Chinese, and he advocated exterminating the race. And when Emperor Hirohito saw this, he said, these people are crazy. If they're going to exterminate yellow race, we have to defend ourselves. Now, Emperor Japan had already had bad experience with the United States during Commodore Perry's invasion. And now they were allies of the United States in World War One, but he saw what the sentiment was against, so he began to defend himself, and he began to sent a spy over to the United States and was able to get the yellow fever virus, and as a marine biologist, he ratcheted up. It's called gain of function nowadays. What this Fauci character was invested in gain-of-function research. Well, Emperor Hirohito did gain-of-function, which would make Fauci look like a little nothing, because the lethality of the yellow fever virus was so strong. He had to ratchet it back down so that it wouldn't kill off the human race. And what he did is he experimented on this. This was a weapon of mass destruction of defense. And he developed these balloons, which were based upon German and American technology. And they improved it, so they would have these huge balloons, and they would go over to China, where they were at war with China, and they would drop these yellow fever bombs that would explode and kill the Chinese in a radius of about, 10 miles, because these Chinese didn't go more than 10 or 20 miles out of their entire lives because of all the ravines. So it could be localized and not only experimented with, but was effective in the Chinese war, because you couldn't take tanks or trucks into those little caverns or those little fjords, whatever they call them in China. So this is why we conduct. Now, the Americans knew all this, and the Americans were very well aware of the yellow fever peril that Emperor Hirohito had developed. So after Pearl Harbor, there was about 6 or 7 weeks in February 24th of the evening over, it was the Battle of Los Angeles, where these huge dirigibles appeared, and airplanes, these could hold airplanes, which would hang off like taking ducks off the scaffolding, and they would go out, and some of them crashed, and the Americans had all of these rockets or bazookas, whatever they were, anti-aircraft is what they would be. And they were shooting them down. It appears in the L.A. press, the Long Beach press, and and then the Secretary of the Navy comes out a couple days later, Frank Knotts, and says, this was just a case of war nerves. There were no craft in the air. It was Japanese. Now, what was so insidious about this is the Americans assumed incorrectly that the Japanese were infesting Los Angeles with yellow fever virus, which they weren't. They were just trying to scare the Americans and get the Americans to do what they wanted, which is to cease and desist and let the Japanese have trade with the rest of the world, because they were cutting off their trade and cutting off their oil. They did not want to destroy the United States. The United States was what they wanted them as a customer. So the United States overreacted. They created a vaccine without testing it and killed immediately 50,000 of their own men, and 300,000 of their own men were disabled and had to be mustered out of the service. So the Japanese had defeated the Americans in Pearl Harbor, and then they defeated them in this war as well 6 weeks later, and the United States was on its heels. And the way they did this was without really doing much of anything. And the way these dirigibles, I should mention, came over was on something called the Kuroshio Current, which the United States had no idea. Emperor Hirohito, there's a current, and you can see it on maps today, goes up the Japanese coast, comes across the top of the Pacific Ocean by the Aleutians, and comes down the Pacific coast, so it can ride over there in 3 days or less, one of these big dirigibles. And this is how powerful the Japanese military was and Emperor Hirohito. And then the Battle of Midway, which America likes to hail as its victory, was not a victory at all. It was a distraction. because they attacked Midway, and while they were really winning the Aleutian Islands, and the reason they wanted the Aleutian Islands was because that's where they could invade America. It was much closer to America than Midway or Hawaii. So they won,
right.
And they took the Aleutian Islands. So and America, so they distracted America at Midway and attacked the Aleutian Islands of Alaska. Now, this also protected their pathway of the Kuroshio Current, but the Americans had no idea what the Kuroshio Current was. And it was when they would fly their airplanes with Jimmy Doolittle and whatnot, they were flying into headwinds. They didn't know what these headwinds were. It was the Kuroshio Current. Now, finally, when the United States figured it out years later, they put together something called the HARP Project in Alaska, the original purpose which was to jam the Kuroshio Current to stop an air invasion from Asia. And when I say
right.
They can always fly airplanes over, but this is dirigibles. And we saw this Chinese air balloon at the beginning of this year. They were using, they'd read this book, obviously, and the Chinese
right.
were now saying, we can use this too, and we can mess with America. It's the first time we've ever heard of a Chinese balloon. But it's the Chinese follow Douglas Dietrich very carefully because
right.
he's the biggest threat to China. He's part Chinese and part Japanese and part American. But he's of mixed racial heritage. But so anyway, this is just some of the intrigue and stuff you're never going to hear. And America has been distracting the public with UFOs, UAPs. We're going to do disclosure. There was a couple years ago, they're saying disclosure. It's disclosure. And they're talking about it. And this book was released on the anniversary of the Roswell incident, 75th anniversary. And the press doesn't want to talk about it. They shut up about this book because it tells it's this actual disclosure of what went on. And they say the book is not a forum on aliens, and it's not a denial of extraterrestrials, but it's if you don't understand the lies, and you know most of what people are buying are just unadulterated lies and hiding the truth of the Japanese. What I would also tell you, Maria, is that when I published my first book, The Montauk Project, Experiments in Time, that book has only been translated, the foreign publishing rights, by countries that either were of Axis nations, that were Axis countries, like Germany. Japan was the first one to publish it. Japan, Germany, Romania, and Bulgaria. And those are the countries, and Russia, which was an Axis country. They published one of my books, and Spain published one book. Spain is, of course, was not an Axis country, but they were Axis allied. So it's only the allied countries that refuse my work. I said I didn't know what that was about, but I finally figured it out because the allies are built on telling so many lies.
Well, I remember when you went to that conference in Romania. Because you work from, like I said, the occult and science, and I remember you saying that there's so much knowledge being passed from people in both fields at the conference, and that it's just such a shame that society isn't aware of it so that they can make their own decisions instead of just following what they're being told. And what I love about about all your books, and you have several, which, by the way, I suggest to people they look at Sky Books, but I find a lot of it is that besides that it's factual and informative, a lot of it is that there are things that people need to know but don't know. So if you don't have any clue, you don't even have a way to think of, well, maybe I can look this up somewhere because it doesn't occur to you. So I find throughout years, you brought so much knowledge to people so they can make conscious decisions about their own lives. I just want to mention that.
I would tell people the website is skybooksusa.com, skybooksusa.com, and anybody interested, I would advise them to order right away because we're closing down next Friday when I go to Romania for 3 weeks. I'll be back on the 16th, but anybody interested in any of the books to see on time travel, there's also the timetraveleducationcenter.com where you can download 7 free videos which explain that time travel is within the bounds of ordinary math and physics, and it demonstrates. It's at an eighth grade level, which I learned from Dr. David Anderson, a time control scientist. But what David Anderson, who's an expert in time travel.
Well, I would just want to say, at the end, I'm going to ask you again to say where your contact information is, because sometimes people don't have a pen or a paper or anything.
I will say it again at the end.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. I'm just going to remind you at the end, because that way gives people time to get something to write. So
I will say it again at the end, yes. Now, Dr. David Anderson, who is the world's leading expert on time and actually has created a time reactor, which is in effect a time machine, has said that the biggest weapon that is used in politics is censorship. Censorship is the key thing. And there's a lot of censorship around his work. Like, it's, I know about it. I've seen an early version of the machine in video. I've had it explained to me. I've explained it to others. I've written about it. But I haven't been able to see the machine itself because there's certain censorship issues and accessibility issues. I think that this might become more accessible or less censored in the next year or two. This is what I've been led to believe. But but censorship around World War II is ridiculous, and around Roswell is just absurd. And again, the book goes into it in quite detail, and it presents it as a legal case, and you become the judge and the juror. If you read the book, and it's very important.
Right, because I find there's always been so much misdirection, and it confuses people because at some point you don't know what to believe, what not to believe, and I find that with your books, especially with this one, but with your books, it's very factual, it's metaphysical, and basically it tells people this is what it is, and then they can make up their own minds how they feel about it, but they're looking at facts and real information that they wouldn't even think to look for. So I always appreciate that you bring information to the public that actually helps all of us.
Well, yes, and there is this book is loaded. My co-author would have made it the size of an encyclopedia if I would have let him, but I didn't have the time for that. Or the money, and he would have just filled it, and it would have, put the ordinary citizen to sleep. However, the quote unquote fellow researchers of World War II would have ignored it, because that's what they do. That's what they do. They short circuit the truth, and they perpetrate a show like Ancient Aliens, which is the most popular show in the history of cable television, yet they're not going to touch this with a 10-foot pole, even though it explains what really happens. And many alternative channels that say, we're interested in the truth, we're interested in alternative theories, they're not interested in alternative theories, especially when they're scorchingly true.
I find that most times that they find that if they bury a lot of the real information, then they can manipulate or control society. And I find that people such as yourself that find out truth and you try to tell people, they're not too happy with you, Peter. We are. We're thrilled you're there.
Well, thank you very much. People tend to go lockstep in line with the the sheeple mentality, that's what people do. And when you step outside of that, you lose them. But to get to the heart of what happened at Roswell, what I say is that in 1946, when there was a peace, a tentative peace, hostilities had stopped in the end of 1946. Now, there were still negotiations going on behind the scenes. And the Japanese allowed the United States to say, hey, we won, we won. They didn't care. They just wanted trade. So trade started to open up and the doors started to loosen. But the Americans had interned Japanese, people who are American citizens, extreme racial bigotry for which they've apologized for. And Franklin Roosevelt was quite a racist. And there's a whole
really
hidden... What?
I said I was really surprised that he was like that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt. Because, you know, especially somebody in charge on those high levels, you just don't associate it with that. However, I know what you mean because he was definitely, I didn't want to say, but pretty much prejudiced. So
yeah, he was worse than prejudiced. He was known as the Butcher of Haiti. And when he was the undersecretary, he was the undersecretary of the Navy. And the Navy, the secretary of the Navy at that time was pretty much dysfunctional, sick, or whatever. So he was running the Navy. But in World War One.
Yeah, and he was making major wartime decisions at the time.
Well, in World War One, Haiti was a big threat to the United States because the Germans had, you know, married into the Haitians, and they were now forming a contingency on the island of Haiti. So FDR went to invade Haiti, and he was there personally. And they were so brutal to the Haitians that he was roasting black people on a spit. And was known as the Butcher of Haiti. And his criminality and genocidal behavior was so bad that when he ran against Warren Harding in 1920, he ran on the ticket as the Vice President Roosevelt. He was not the presidential candidate. In 1920, Warren Harding, who was a member of the KKK, called out Roosevelt for his horrendous actions in Haiti, and that helped Harding win the election because of Roosevelt's racial hatred and genocidal behavior against black people. And here was Harding, who was a member of the KKK, was using it to his advantage. It was shortly after that that FDR contracted polio. It was like a karmic...
I was just going to say, you got to love karma. I truly believe, and I know you do too, I truly believe that whatever you do, good, better, and different, eventually comes back. I really do. I really believe in karma. And the funny part is every culture believes in karma. They just use different words for it.
What's even more interesting about this is FDR had created a whole war plan when he was Secretary of the Navy to take over the world. He wanted to invade Canada. It was called War Plan, I think, Crimson. A plane to invade England was War Plan Red. He had different colors to invade all these countries of the world. And
I remember you saying it was called the Rainbow something. What was that, Rainbow War Plan?
Yeah, because it was using all the colors of the rainbow to invade different countries. Now,
amazing.
You'd think that Canada is a great ally of the United States, and you'd think the same for England. But what FDR wanted, see, he was threatening Canada. He had troops along the border ready to invade Canada in the 1930s. And England was running scared because of what the Germans were doing in Europe. So their refuge of the crown, the King of England, was to go to Canada because that's their country. If England wasn't successfully invaded by the Germans, which it looked like it would be. So what FDR got out of this, what he really wanted, was the drug trade out of the Golden Triangle in Southeast Asia, which was owned by the British going back to, you know, hundreds of years, the opium wars and all that. The opium funded the British Empire, and the Chinese were forced to buy the equivalent of about 10 pounds of opium per month to support the British Empire. And, of course,
oh, that's
the Chinese hated the British.
Yeah, I'm saying that's crazy.
And FDR was able to say, by threatening to invade Canada, he says, well, you know, if you give us the drug trade, we won't invade Canada, and you can come there in case you lose. And then FDR then got the drug trade, and then he was happy. And of course, this created the Flying Tigers, who went in and exported the drugs, the infamous Flying Tigers. We go into the history of the Flying Tigers and how they were formed. FDR's top economic advisor was a communist who worked for Stalin. And he was investigated, and it was pretty much condemned for it. But FDR kind of rescued him and got him a new job, eventually settling him in Colombia. So FDR's, you know, was a very, very evil man, but a very powerful man. Now, but when we fast forward up to 1946, when hostilities had ended, the war was not over, but and of course all these Japanese were in camps. They were still interned, and including at Roswell, where there was a big camp. There's even a memorial there. But in 1946, the Navy sent Admiral Byrd and a team of real military people, which he was not, to Antarctica, right, called Operation High Jump. And, of course, there's been many stories linked to this, but what's known about it is that they came back early. Because they were going there to eliminate the surviving military faction of the Third Reich, which had very advanced technology, what we would call flying saucers, and they escaped to the Third Reich with all this technology, and they also had the use. The Germans had the use of advanced Japanese radar, which is mentioned in the book, and anyway. Admiral Byrd and that contingency was beaten badly, and they came back just after a few months. They couldn't sustain themselves. They were beaten by the Germans. And then, so what the United States thought, well, if we can't beat them that way, maybe we can use the dirigibles that the Japanese have. Now, I'll explain how the dirigibles came over to the United States. When the Hiroshima bomb was dropped, and the Hiroshima bomb was not an American bomb. It was called Fat Man. And Man was actually obtained from the Germans. The Germans had atomic warfare. The Japanese did too. And this is even documented in the book. It's not that hidden.
No.
But
by the way,
go ahead.
I just want to mention that, and I absolutely recommend this book, but I just want to mention for people that are interested in this, and everybody really should be, that there are pictures of the balloons, and there's pictures of all sorts of scientific gadgets and people, and, you know, so it's really interesting because not only do you explain it, people can visually see, you know, the progress of things, and when you have pictures of, as an example, newspapers and different things. So, you know, when they're looking at this and, you know, and they're reading the book, it's actually connected in so many different ways that you can't possibly look at this and go, oh, I'm not sure. So I just love that you do that like that.
Well, thank you.
Very
people can go into denial, but they can't rationally dismiss it. Now, so anyway, what happened when, the Germans had, the Germans had surrendered, but it wasn't the German Reich that surrendered, it was the German military. It was not the, not the duly elected government of Germany, so technically America is still at war with Germany. They're not at war with Japan. This is why we're still on daylight saving time, but that's another story, which is mentioned in the book. So anyway, but the So anyway, when they dropped the bomb on Hiroshima, Emperor Hirohito immediately sent 3 dirigibles to America. And
really?
They got there. They were huge dirigibles, and they had on them enough weapons to show that they could destroy the United States. And the United, of course, now these were manned with planes. They were manned with these kind of called the Zimmer Skimmer. They were based on an American design. They flew real fast. They looked kind of like flying saucers. And they had these weapons that the Japanese were saying, hey, look, we can wipe out the United States. And they had these Yakuza. The Yakuza were the little tiny people of Japan. Japanese soldiers were already tiny. These guys were no more, just a little over 4 feet. They were small. And the craft were crafted towards them. And the Yakuza cut off their little finger as an act of atonement. They were a gang culture. And
right.
Most of them had 3 fingers. And so, as you'll see, they later could easily be construed as aliens. But they were the pilots. Now, Americans took the weapons of mass destruction and evaluated them at Fort Detrick, Maryland, and said, yeah, these things could kill us. So at that point, a peace back channel was negotiated between the Japanese and the Americans. Initial peace talks that were translated by Douglas's mother, who worked for the emperor. Yeah, she ended up marrying an American sailor, and that's how, Douglas was born in Taiwan and they came to America, which is a whole other story, but that's who she was. She was a very important lady. And so he also learned things from her, but she was there translating these back channel negotiations. But what happened was the Americans they took these little Yakuza and made them prisoners. They didn't release them. And they also took the ships, the craft. There were 2 of them that made it, and 1 crashed on the way. And they wanted to take these craft and take them down to Antarctica and, fight the Germans, which was a stupid idea. But nevertheless, they were trying it, and the Americans were too big to fit into the craft, so they were forcibly torturing or manipulating the Yakuza to do their bidding. And the Yakuza revolted, and some of them escaped in these little planes called Zimmer Skimmers, and they were the ones flying over Washington State when Kenneth Arnold saw them. And this is where the word flying saucer was coined, because they looked like saucers, but they were really round planes. We have pictures of them in the book, and pictures of Kenneth Arnold holding up this thing. And this is the military saying, okay, Kenneth Arnold, what you saw were flying saucers. And they weren't flying saucers, but this created the flying saucer myth and started it. Now, when they were using what Yakuza didn't escape, and they were flying over Roswell, over Four Corners area, the winds began to kick up, and these Japanese, who were not afraid of suicide, rather than capitulate to the Americans, we don't want to be part of this, they crashed the balloon. They set it on fire because it was very flammable. Oh. It crashed. Some of them survived. Some of them were dead, and their bodies were burnt. They were orange, and then they turned gray. And this has gone into the detail of eyewitnesses who said, they looked Asian, or they looked Japanese, the people who saw the initial bodies. And the little coffins, these were for little people. Oh. So it's like all of these stories, and then the myth was eventually reinvented in the 70s by Satanist Michael Aquino, who was the worked at the Presidio, and he was in charge of psychological operations. And he was asked to make this Roswell myth stick so that people would think there's aliens. And he was very good at his job. It worked very well. And, of course, Douglas worked for Aquino, not because he wanted to, but because he was a Defense Department research librarian, and he was bite. He was forced to, in the library exchange program, obtain grimoire, which are basically grammar or ancient spells that Aquino would use with his coven in the library. And he was subjected to watching Aquino, or not maybe say watching him, but he's in the background of the library. He had to do the rituals in the library because he wasn't allowed to take the materials out of the library. So Douglas was subjected to a lot of occult phenomena as well, which we're dissecting in a new book. But
right, and grimoire, you know, they're very, very intense, ancient, mainly ancient spells, you know, or formulae. And, you know, we update, so we have our own. We use the ancient ones. We use very, very powerful ones. But most of society doesn't understand that. And it's really on the intense levels. Really shouldn't be used by people that don't know how to work with energy. You know,
well, yes, and it's important to point out that there is always an occult war or battlefield beneath the political world you see on TV, which is just really watered down silliness in terms of truly understanding it. But Maria,
I just want to say, we only have a couple more minutes, but I want to make sure that if there's something else you want to say, you know, that we get that in before we have to wrap up.
Yes, and what I want to say is there's many people listening to me that I've brought with me from my regular audience who are new to you, and I would like you to give your contact information, because we haven't really talked about you, and maybe we can interview you on Douglas's show before I go to Romania, if you would like that. We need to set up the technical details of that. I'd like to introduce you to my audience if you give your contact information.
Yeah, and that would be wonderful. And I just really mainly wanted to focus this whole show just on you, because really I feel that you're such a phenomenal person and you bring so much to the world and to people and, you know, society in general, that I wanted people to get a better idea of what you do and who you are. And even though we're focused on the Roswell Deception book, which I think is phenomenal, and I really think everybody should get this, but you also have so many other books that they really need to look that up and look at some of your other books, because I've read your books, and there's always so much underground knowledge that society actually needs to know to be able to make better decisions about society, their personal lives, how to move on things, what to believe, what not to believe, you know. So I'm just very thrilled to have you on the show.
Well, thank you. And I would suggest people that want to be introduced to my regular work would read the Silver Anniversary Edition of the Montauk Project, Experiments in Time. That's written 25 years after the original book, and it goes into much more detail on the phenomena that happened during the time experiments at Montauk and how I came to understand time travel better, and it gives the scientific explanations of time as well in there.
You know what? You and I have been doing this for so many years, because obviously it's not something new to us. We've been doing this forever. And I find our knowledge, and especially the way you look at things, which is, like I said, scientific and metaphysical, that it's so much underground knowledge that people wouldn't even have an idea of how to look for it or what to look for. And honestly, it's not going to occur to society just plain because they don't have an idea about it. So the fact that you bring all this knowledge out so that people can think about it and look at, you know, what's reality to them and make their own decisions, because what I love is you present the facts, and they are facts. You present the facts, you talk about what's actually going on or what was going on in the past, and you always let people make up their own minds, which I have to give you a lot of credit for, because I know some people that are teaching, lecturing, writing, you know, if you don't agree with them 100%, you know, they get a little crazy, you know, they get offended, and with the facts, they speak for themselves. So I find all your books are like that, and they're all very, very unique and informative, and I'm just happy to be your friend, and I really hope that you're going to be writing this forever.
Well, thank you so much, Maria, and I can, you know, my books can be accessed at skybooksusa.com, skybooksusa.com. Get your orders in ASAP because we're closing down for 3 weeks next Friday. So get them in if you're interested in any of the books.
And you were saying the contact for time, you said the time travel one. What was that one?
TimeTravelEducationCenter.com. The TimeTravelEducationCenter.com, where you'll get emails when I'm appearing on a show like this, and also you'll get 7 free videos that demonstrate that time travel is within the bounds of ordinary math and physics.
Which is phenomenal. Do you have an email or any other way that they can get in touch with you? Or this is basically
people want to contact me, they can go to petermoon333@gmail.com, petermoon333@gmail.com.
Okay, @gmail.com, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I just want to repeat, petermoon333@gmail.com. And Peter is always very, very good about answering as soon as he can. And I just want to let you know, because I'm the same way, sometimes, you know, we happen to be doing things like, you know, working, speaking, lecturing. So if you don't get an immediate answer, nobody's ignoring you. As soon as Peter or I could possibly get to it, we always get back to you as fast as we possibly can. And I find among my other disciplines, I'm a professional psychic, published author, metaphysician, shaman, creative business consultant, and I lecture on the spiritual, psychic, and paranormal fields. And you can reach me at MariaDeAndrea100@gmail.com, MDeAndrea100@gmail.com, and my website is MariaDeAndrea.com. Obviously, I am not a computer person, and my phone number is 631-559-1248. And I do suggest to people that you read anything, actually anything that Peter ever wrote. He's just phenomenal in this field. And honestly, in a field where, and I don't mean this in a negative sense, in a field where we have wonderful, wonderful people, but just like any other business, we have a lot of charlatans. And Peter is one of those people that you feel blessed that you met and that he's actually a teacher. He may not look at it like that, but when he's lecturing or writing books, he's actually teaching. Because when you're an author, one of the reasons you write is because you want to spread knowledge that can go out to everybody, not just when you're lecturing a few people at a time. So if you don't mind giving your contact information again.
SkybooksUSA.com, SkybooksUSA.com, or TimeTravelEducationCenter.com.
Okay. And your email is PeterMoon333@gmail.com.
Yes.
So I really thank you so much for being on the show. It is really such a pleasure. And hopefully we get to talk about something else soon, or we can talk about this a little bit more. Honestly, there is so much information in this book that there is just no way to cover it in the time that we're allotted. And it's so very interesting. And by the way, I love that you have pictures of the balloons and ships and everything else and people, because sometimes some people are visual, some people basically are better at reading or listening. So you really cover everything.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Yeah. And I did want to mention, by the way, that people can call both of us to do lectures and to do seminars and to do conferences and to speak on numerous subjects in the fields that we're in. And we do travel, so we're not limited to the areas that we live in. So if anybody's interested, they can get in touch with both of us.
And I want to thank you both for a great show, and it was very interesting. And I got to close with our standard disclaimer, an Olympian disclaimer. Aristotle suggested that entertaining new thoughts without feeling obliged to accept them is a wise practice to cultivate. We agree. Our Olympian podcasts explore interesting thoughts and viewpoints on a variety of topics, including health, religion, and politics. Our explorations give voice to diverse personal opinions, areas of study, and systems. Discussions in this forum, though sincere and enthusiastic, are not to be construed as Mount Olympus's endorsement of any particular point of view. That said, thank you both again for a very interesting and exciting and thought-provoking show.
Okay,
thank you so much.
Thank you, and wonderful day, both of you. Bye.
Okay, good night.
Good night.